Hello everyone and welcome to a new edition of
Tracing Text
with Anton
and Sylvia,
coming to you live from deep in the heart of the state of Tennessee. And today we have a show that
is going to be focusing on your topic, Anton. Tell us about your author and what you have titled this episode number 8.
Well, this episode of Tracing Texts will be called Álvaro Cunqueiro and Sophisticated or Reconstructive Literature.
Okay, excellent. So you're going to be talking about this particular author, Álvaro Cunqueiro. Tell us a little bit about his biography before we begin and delving into his work.
Well, in my opinion, Álvaro Cunqueiro is one of the most important writers in Spain in the 20th century. And unfortunately, I don't think he has achieved the amount of recognition that he deserves for several different reasons. And not that our podcast is going to make him instantly world known and world famous, but he's a writer that has always been important to me. I've read his works for a very long time, since I was a teenager or so. And I'm actually working on a project about him, and particularly about his prose, about his novels. And so that's why I chose him to showcase his work on this new edition of Tracing Texts. He wrote both in Galician and in Spanish. He was from Galicia in the northwest of Spain. He actually was born in the town of Mondoñedo in 1911, and he died in Vigo, my hometown,
in 1981. Okay, how interesting.
When he was just 69, actually. He wasn't really
not that old, no.
When he died. He often translated into Spanish some of the texts that he had originally written in Galician, and then he would also write other texts, particularly articles, journalistic articles in Spanish, and then a lot of his works were actually written in Galician. He was a multifaceted writer. He wrote poetry and drama and newspaper articles, essays about all sorts of topics like literature, history, art, folklore, cuisine even.
Wow. Yeah. So he's definitely very talented in all sorts of fields.
Well, he was a man that really liked to eat. That is for sure. And that's one of the reasons why he enjoyed writing about food and about the Galician cuisine and that sort of stuff. He was also a translator, but he is best known for his narrative works and especially his novels. And we're going to be talking today about one of those novels, and we'll introduce that a little bit later on.
So can you tell us a little bit about his formative years, his education?
Yes, he was interested in literature from a very early age. He went to college in Santiago, which is
Santiago de Compostela.
Santiago de Compostela, yeah, of course. Okay. And everyone probably knows about Santiago de Compostela because of El Camino de Santiago, or St. James's Way, the pilgrimage, right?
Exactly.
And the big, beautiful cathedral that lies there. But he really didn't care too much about his studies. At some point, he decided to quit and become a journalist. I suppose this was at a time when a journalism degree wasn't absolutely necessary,
right,
to become a journalist. And, you know, in these early years, he also distinguished himself as a Galician nationalist and one of the founding members of the Partido Galeguista, which is a nationalist party, or was a nationalist party that he was a part of back in those days. However, in his 20s, during the Spanish Civil War, he happened to be on Franco's side.
Interesting.
For a while. Yes. And after the war, during the first few years of Franco's dictatorship, starting in 1939, he published articles in many of publications that were leaning towards the Francoist ideology.
Right. Franco was also Galician, wasn't he?
That's right. I don't think that would be the reason why.
But he just kind of subscribed to that, leaned towards the Francoist ideology at the time.
Many times during civil wars, you know, depending on where you are at the time that it breaks out, you may be caught in one faction or another.
Right.
And that might be one of the things that led him to this situation. But, you know, he definitely took advantage of the fact that Franco won the war, the nationalist side won the war, and, you know, during the first few years of Franco's dictatorship in the 1940s, he was collaborating with a lot of the publications that were upholding that sort of ideology. He even moved to Madrid to work for the newspaper ABC or ABC, which is one of the most important newspapers really in Spain, even right now, and fairly conservative one at that. And of course, as you can imagine, Sylvia, in a highly politicized world that we're living in right now, and pretty much always have throughout the 20th century and before, all of this would earn him a great deal of criticism from left-leaning writers and left-leaning critics, and this may really be one of the reasons why he isn't as well-known these days as he should be, or as other more left-leaning writers of the time, like García Lorca, for example, Alberti, and several others,
tend to be. So generally, writers tend to be left-leaning, and he is not so much so. So that could have potentially been a reason.
At least he wasn't during a part of his life, an important part in the history of Spain too, because it's the Civil War and the post-war period, the immediate post-war period. However, in the mid 1940s, around 1944, 1945, important time as well.
It's during the end of World War II.
He distanced himself from the regime of Franco and returned to his home area of Galicia, where he had been born. These were very difficult times for him because you have to think that it's not easy to distance yourself from the dictatorship, especially when you have been collaborating with it for a while. I'm not going to go into the reasons why he did so, but these were very difficult times for him.
I can imagine.
He was stripped of his journalism certificate for a while, which meant that he was not able to actually work.
Which is interesting. He didn't have a degree in journalism, but you had to have a journalism certificate to work.
Actually,
sort of like a license.
Bit like a license. Yeah. The word in Spanish is carnet. Right?
Okay.
So it really, he did not have a degree in journalism,
but you had to have that official documentation to be able to do.
Yes, he was allowed to work as a journalist because he had that certificate, which I suppose was government issued. But when he distanced himself ideologically and also physically in many ways from the dictatorship, he was stripped of that. And so for a while he wasn't able to find any work as a journalist. He would freelance for a bit. And those were really difficult times for him in the mid to late 1940s and early 1950s. There are several letters. He was a huge letter writer. He wrote, his correspondence is really enormous. And so some of the letters that he wrote, particularly to his really good friend, really close friend, Francisco Fernández del Riego, show these difficult times for him and how he's always asking del Riego for the chance to publish this or that article. He talks a lot about the works in progress that he's working on and that sort of thing. So those were really complicated times for Álvaro Cunqueiro. But he eventually found work with several different Galician newspapers and publications, some really important ones like La Voz de Galicia, which is, of course, still going strong these days, La Noche. And then in the 1950s, he began to work for Faro de Vigo. Now, Faro de Vigo is the newspaper from my hometown, from Vigo.
Okay, and it's still...
And it's still an important newspaper, not necessarily because it's distributed all over Spain, which, you know...
It's more of a regional newspaper.
It is, although you can find it in other parts of Spain. But the important thing about this newspaper was that it was founded in 1853.
Oh,
so
wow.
It's the oldest newspaper in Spain that is still open and still working.
How interesting.
So he worked for them, and he actually became the director for several years in the 1960s of El Faro de Vigo. Mm-hmm. So, you know, that sort of helped him economically, but it also gave him an outlet for a lot of the very interesting articles that he wrote. All of these, of course, or most of these, in Spanish.
Okay.
Not
in Galicia.
Not in Galician. Now, what is the most successful period of his career, of his literary career? No doubt between the late 1950s and the late 1970s, so almost like a 20-year span.
Right.
Where he devoted himself solely to writing, and he wrote all sorts of works and uh-huh. won several important literary awards, like the Premio Nacional de la Critica, the National Prize, in 1959, and the Premio Nadal, which was one of the most important.
Yeah, it's a very important prize
in Spain at the time. In 1968, he got that one. So, you know, that's pretty much the background information that people out there should mm-hmm. know about this writer, Álvaro Cunqueiro, who, as we said at the beginning, is perhaps not as renowned or as right. recognized as he maybe should be.
Right. So tell us a little bit about his work now that you've told us about his, you know, his education, his career in general.
Yes, Cunqueiro was at the very beginning of his career, when he began writing, he was a poet.
Mm-hmm.
He concentrated on poetry in the 1930s, and he wrote collections that could be ascribed to the avant-garde. Of course, pretty much everyone was doing that at the
right.
time in Spain and elsewhere. And also, he followed this trend that was popular in Galicia at the time, which was called el neo-trovadorismo, or new troubadourism. I'm not even sure if that's
How long did this period last?
It didn't really last for a very long time, but it was important in the resurgence of literature written in Galicia.
Like, is it folk tale related? Like, is it that? Does it have those sort of elements? Is that why it's called?
It's more related to the long-standing tradition of medieval cantigas
right.
and the old songs and poems written by the troubadours in the Middle
right.
Ages in Galicia and other parts of Europe. That's why it's called neo-trovadorismo,
mm-hmm.
like the new way of writing like the old troubadours.
Okay.
This is, would also be, and we'll talk about this maybe a little bit later, what I would call sophisticated and reconstructive literature, because the idea is to reconstruct a kind of literature, to bring back a kind of literature from the past.
And make it current?
That's right, and make
okay.
it current, which is really what he does
okay.
in a lot of his poetry, and definitely in a lot of his prose. So some examples of this would be a couple of books that he wrote, a couple of collections of poetry that he wrote in Galician in the 1930s. Mar ao Norte,
mm-hmm.
which is something like, could be translated as Sea to the North.
Right.
And Cantiga Nova que se chama Ribeira, so the new song called Ribeira.
Uh-huh.
Again, Cantiga Nova, the new song, harking back to the medieval times,
right.
but making it new in a way. So
even
though it looks like the avant-garde and the neo-trovadorismo are very different, they really spring from the same idea, the
mm-hmm.
idea of making something new, but in this case using the past and bringing the past to the present.
Right.
He also wrote a couple of plays, and the most famous of them is one which is really his own take on the history of Hamlet.
Oh, how interesting.
El incierto señor Don Hamlet. the uncertain Mr. Hamlet, really, or something like that.
What do you think prompted him to write that play? Just
well, he talks about that in some of the interviews that
uh-huh.
he gave. And some of them can actually be found on YouTube.
Oh, okay, I'll have to check those out.
And he talks about how he wanted to rewrite Hamlet from a different perspective. And that's another thing, again, trying to look at something from the past, trying to make it current, make it different, and create something different, something new from something that comes from a certain tradition. In this case, the theater of Shakespeare, of which he was a big fan, and he really enjoyed the theater of Shakespeare. He also wrote a couple of collections of what is known in Spanish as semblanzas, literary portraits of real characters that he knew, that actually mix reality and fiction. It's not just a real portrait of a person, but it mixes in some
fictionalizes somebody's life, so that they would be like people that he knows or kind of maybe prominent figures in society that day.
Not necessarily prominent, just people that he knew from
his day-to-day
who lived in the Galician villages that he knew. And, you know, he used to like going to bars and taverns and just sit around, drink wine, and talk to the people. And he got a lot of information, a lot of material for
and then he would elaborate. Portraits.
And then he would elaborate and include, because basically the main thing about Cunqueiro's work is his penchant for imagination, for fiction, and for narrating things that are strange and surprising in a way that within the text isn't really surprising at all. Does that ring a bell?
Right, exactly.
With magical realism.
Exactly.
He was a master at these semblanzas or portraits. Some of the best pages that he ever wrote are these short
semblanzas,
yes, and portraits. And really, the mixture of reality and fiction, as I'm saying, you know, the real world and the mythical elements is a main feature, is a main characteristic of the works of Álvaro Cunqueiro. He also began writing novels in the 1950s. So first and foremost, he was a poet at the very beginning of his career. But then in the 50s, he transitions into
prose.
And there are several different reasons for that. Let's remember that during Franco, writing in Galician was not accepted. Had been banned for a while. And of course, in the 1950s, this begins to change a little bit. And Cunqueiro believed that writing prose in Galician was very important to bring the language back.
Right.
Remember that this nationalist
tendency,
feeling,
he's always had that. He has Galician nationalism.
Yes. He does have this love of the Galician language, Galician culture. And in many ways, he follows these nationalist ideas.
Right.
And he did throughout his whole life, although, you know, they evolved over the years, of course. But he thought that writing prose was very important for the Galician language, and so he wrote several novels, usually in Galician and then translated by himself.
Into Spanish.
Into Spanish.
Okay.
Some of them are Merlin y Familia. We'll talk about this one today, from 1955. And then there are others like Las Crónicas del Sochantre from 1956, Las Mocedades de Ulises from 1960, Si Obello Sinbad Volvese a Sillas, If Old Sinbad Went Back to the Islands from 1961. Then another one called Un Hombre Que Se Parecía a Orestes from 1969. That's the one that he won the Nadal Prize for. A man that looked like Orestes. So again, as you can see,
referring back to mythology,
he's referring
like to
back
Ulysses,
to mythology, yes.
Orestes.
But not Orestes. not just a classical mythology, but also the mythology of King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table. Also Asian or, you know, Oriental mythology as well, when he has this novel that deals with Sinbad, right? And so, you know,
like A Thousand and One Nights.
A Thousand and One Nights, and he was interested in all sorts of folk tales from all over the world, but also the original or traditional folk tales from his birthplace of Galicia. Now, the epitaph on his gravestone reads, and this is, I think, pretty interesting and gives you an idea of the kind of person that Cunqueiro was. It reads, "Here lies someone who, with his work, made Galicia last another thousand springs."
Oh, so that's a pretty...
It's really beautiful.
Yes,
right?
It's beautiful.
But it also means, you know, that he placed a lot of importance on the works that he wrote in Galician as a way to kind of uphold a tradition.
Keep
that,
it alive.
Yes.
That rebirth of, or, you know, the continuing of that literature. Basically.
Which is a tradition that he sensed as a long-standing tradition of hundreds of years.
Right.
So. You're listening to Tracing Texts with
Sylvia
and Anton, and we're talking today about Álvaro Cunqueiro,
the
Galician writer from the northwest of Spain. And we've talked a little bit about his life, we've talked a little bit about the kinds of works that he wrote, and now we're going to concentrate on...
Well, you told me that you were going to talk about sophisticated or reconstructive literature, so I'm going to ask you why you chose that, what does it mean for our listeners?
Well, sophisticated or reconstructive literature comes from the critical world of philosophical materialism as literary criticism.
Right.
And sophisticated or reconstructive literature denotes a type of literature that uses irrational elements in a rational and critical way,
mm-hmm.
but very often also in a playful way.
Okay.
So that the writers that deal in this kind of literature, whether it be in prose or in verse, could also be drama. You know, we're
right.
talking in the case of Cunqueiro more about his prose, more about his novels and short sketches.
Uh-huh.
The writers that deal in this kind of literature take something that's irrational, like
uh-huh.
magic,
uh-huh.
like the supernatural, things that can't be explained rationally necessarily, that come from myths from
uh-huh.
the past, from, you know, traditions that go back to the beginning of time. And they bring those traditions, those myths,
to
the present. You know, but they do so in a critical way, in a rational, critical way, as a way to talk about the complexity
mm-hmm.
of the modern world.
Right.
Using elements from times gone by.
Mm-hmm.
So, really... what they're doing is they're bringing mythical elements from the past into the present in a critical and a rational way, and these elements are seen as normal within the fictional world of the literary work. So magic doesn't seem strange.
Right,
for
it's just
example.
Part of the rationale, the cosmovision of what the existence of that world, like you mentioned.
That's right, and so... you know, this makes Cunqueiro, in my opinion, one of the pioneers of what is known as magical realism or realismo mágico in Spanish. And you know, when one thinks about magical realism, of course
we're thinking of the early ones, Carpentier, Borges, and then we have García Márquez, and then some of the other boom writers like Fuentes, or you know.
So we usually think very specifically of Latin American literature.
Right.
Right. But of course, this sort of trend, you know,
mm-hmm.
this sort of technique does not appear in a void.
Right. It's always influenced or informed by other writers.
And in this case, I think Cunqueiro is a good candidate, if not to be the inventor, because
right.
who knows, you know. Who is the inventor of magical realism, or of anything, really.
Right.
But he definitely is one of the forebears. If you read his first two novels, for example,
mm-hmm.
Merlin y Familia,
mm-hmm.
Las Crónicas del Sochantre, both of them from the mid-1950s,
right.
you can see these elements that would later be known as realismo mágico, or magical realism,
right.
already very clearly developed in his fiction. So... You know, when tracing,
right.
which is something we do here.
That's what we're trying to figure out, right?
when tracing the origins of something, one has to be very careful
because
one may not have always read everything.
Right. Of that author or any other author for that matter. Yeah, that's very true.
So Álvaro Cunqueiro has hardly ever been credited with this, but he definitely seems to be one of the forebears, the pioneers of... magical realism. We can see this very clearly in Merlin y Familia, originally written in Galician as Merlin e Familia,
right.
In 1955, and then translated by himself into Spanish. It was his first novel.
Mm-hmm.
It was written at a very prolific time in his career. As we said before, when he had moved back from Madrid to Galicia. And was still struggling to find steady work as a journalist, but he was writing a lot during that time period. Fortunately, this book has been translated into English, not by Conqueiro. I don't know who translated it, really, because I don't have
the edition
in English. Okay. I read it both in Galician and then in Spanish. But it was published by Everyman's Library.
Okay.
And so it is translated into English as Merlin and Company, not Merlin and Family, as you
because
might think.
Because it would not make sense.
That's right.
It would be a kind of a too literal of a translation.
So it was translated as Merlin and Company, and I just checked this morning, and it's still available, for example, from Amazon. So this would be a good way to, if you don't read in Spanish, if you don't read in Galician, to actually have access to the work of Álvaro Cunqueiro by reading in English. And I don't know if the translation is good or bad. I haven't checked it. But in any case, it gives you a chance to actually have access to his literary universe. This is a very significant work in his production. And what is the novel about?
Yeah, why does he use the image of or the figure of Merlin?
Well, Cunqueiro was really interested in the folklore of different parts of the world, but in particular Galician and Celtic folklore and myths.
And Galicia is very much the mythology or the folklore is very much based on a Celtic background, right?
Yeah, there's a very strong Celtic element to some of the traditions and beliefs and folk tales of Galicia, and perhaps because the Celts are supposed to have lived there. There are Celtic remnants, Celtic music is played, some Celtic-like festivals are still celebrated over there. It's not clear to what extent the Celts really lived there, how many were there, how long they lived there, and how deep the influence really is. But there seems to be a certain, Celtic influence from centuries ago.
So those traces are there.
They seem to be there, yes. Sometimes I think those traces have been exaggerated intensely, and sometimes with a political interest.
Like maybe the nationalist element.
The nationalist element, and definitely during the 19th century when, early 19th century, mid-19th century, with this romantic view the culture of the people as something that distinguishes a certain, part of Spain from another part of Spain. So this mythical, really.
Right, and it was occurring in other parts of Europe, like with the Grimm's, their compilation of fairy tales, for example, and other places were doing similar.
Yeah, if you think, for example, of the Galician anthem, there is such a thing as the Galician anthem. It was written by Eduardo Pondal. The lyrics were written by Eduardo Pondal, who was a very important romantic Galician poet. And, of course, the lyrics talk a lot about how the Galician people is or descends from the old Celtic myths of Breogán and all that sort of thing. So, yes, there's definitely that element, that feature there.
Okay.
And Cunqueiro was extremely interested in that. And that is why he was interested in the figure of Merlin and the Knights of the Round Table. But is this a chivalric book? Like those that Don Quixote liked to read so much?
Not really.
Not really, no.
So what does it deal with?
Well, the novel presents an elderly Merlin. It's not Merlin in his prime, so to speak. And he has decided to retire.
Okay.
And of course, when it comes time for a wizard to retire, where in the world would he go?
Well, I think maybe Spain, Galicia.
Exactly. So he decides to retire in a place called Miranda in the mountains of Galicia.
Okay.
And of course, you know, there's a similarity in the landscape of, you know, some parts of Galicia and, you know, some parts of Brittany and France and, of course, Wales and Scotland and Ireland and the Isle of Man and, you know, all those supposed Celtic nations, you know. So, yes, I mean, of course, if you have been a wizard all your really long life and you've done all those deeds that,
magical feats.
You would like to retire in a place that is sort of recognizable to you, but that is also sort of quiet and calm and a place where you can actually just sit back and relax. And okay. So he decides, Merlin decides to retire in Galicia. And, of course, he only works occasionally. Because he's retired, right?
Yeah,
now, when I'm retired, I don't want to work too much.
Me
right?
neither.
So he only works occasionally when some kind of interesting character drops by for some sort of social call. He just pops around for a visit. You know?
Okay.
Or to ask for Merlin's help. Sometimes it's not just a visit to chat
of
with him.
Of course, but they want something.
They need something
they
from
need
him.
Something.
His fame has preceded him, and so they know where he's at. I'm not sure why, but they follow him.
They find
to,
him.
To the mountains of Galicia and find him, and you know that is the beginning of a certain story. So that's basically what the novel is about. But the interesting thing is we don't have this omniscient narrator. We don't have even Merlin as a first-person narrator telling this story. But what we have is Felipe mm-hmm. as the narrator. And Felipe is one of Merlin's servants in Galicia.
Okay.
Who, as an older man, remembers his time working in Galicia for Merlin. And reflects on some of the things that he saw back then.
Okay.
So, basically, when Merlin retires to Galicia, to the mountains of Galicia, he, of course, needs some help. And one of his servants was Felipe.
Uh-huh.
So, later on, as an old man, Felipe sits down and either writes or, you know, remembers all of these stories that happened
mm-hmm.
while he was in Merlin's service, when Merlin was in Galicia in retirement. So, in this sense, what we have here is a sort of memoir.
Okay.
And Felipe is looking back in time, and he's offering his recollections of things past,
okay.
which, you know...
which, where you said, we're trying to reconstruct the past
that's right.
for the present.
But he is actually remembering the past,
mm-hmm.
right? And at the same time, bringing that past into the present, because mm-hmm. this is not Merlin...
No.
As part of the Arthurian cycle.
No, it's just...
It's just Merlin in retirement...
And he just happens, it's kind of like a way of bringing it all back.
That's right.
An excuse to tell the story.
What it is it's really an excuse.
Yeah.
Yes, you're absolutely
it's
right.
It's an excuse to tell the story.
So throughout the book, because of this setting,
uh-huh.
right, action takes a backseat mm-hmm. to storytelling. And storytelling is very important in the works of Cunqueiro. It always was. Anything that you read by Cunqueiro, whether it's his articles or his plays even,
mm-hmm.
or his novels, you know, storytelling, la fabulación,
mm-hmm.
right, is what's going to be most important. So most of the time it isn't Felipe telling the stories.
Mm-hmm.
There is a polyphony of voices, so many different voices, tell the stories. So the stories are told by some of these visitors
okay.
that come to ask for Merlin's help or just to visit him, by some of the people who work for Merlin with Felipe, sometimes by Merlin himself.
Mm-hmm.
So there are stories within stories, you know, so this makes the narrative structure a lot more complex, and of course it brings us back to the idea of Cervantes's Don Quixote, when we have stories within stories and different narrators and that sort of thing. So
right.
this makes the novel a lot more interesting than just a straight ahead telling of this or that story about Merlin,
right.
Which is one, I think, of the things that Cunqueiro did very well in this particular novel and in many others that he wrote later. The character of Merlin is really not as important as the stories that he and these characters tell.
It's sort of like 1001 Nights, because you have like the main characters, but really it's this, each story. It's kind of a grouping of all these tales put together. So in some ways it's similar, isn't
that's
it?
That's really a good point. And Cunqueiro, if you read his articles, you know, and there are many that have been collected and published in book form, even while he was still alive.
Right.
Some of them are actually incredibly entertaining and very funny. But one thing that is clear is that Cunqueiro, by reading these articles, we can see that he really knew a lot about world literature.
Right.
His literature of all parts of the world. He had a lot of time
to read and to really, like, he knows his stuff. He really could dig deep to, to really get his material.
And he could be talking about, you know, German literature. He translated Hölderlin, for example, into Galician.
Right.
Or he could be talking about Asian literature, or he could be talking about medieval literature, but he always speaks in such a way that it's clear that he knows what he's talking about.
Right.
So he has a very clear, very deep command of, you know, literary history. He has read a lot. He has read more than I think probably you and I put together would read it throughout our whole lives.
Yes.
Yeah, that's
twice.
I mean, I know you read a lot, but...
Well, I don't know about that. I'm a slow reader, but...
So, you know, the narrator does not really offer too many detailed descriptions of Merlin, and he prefers to concentrate on the tales.
Right.
And many of those tales bring old myths that Cunqueiro had researched into the modern age, because remember, Merlin is now retired.
Now I want to
find the hills in the mountains of Galicia.
Now I want to find out if he has any like folk tales. Remember, I told you I just a little side note about mermaids in Celtic.
Well, you know,
And now I'm going to have to read all his stuff.
I remember that you had asked me several times about, is there any collection of Galician folk tales that deal with mermaids? And I did some research, and I talked to some friends who know about this kind of stuff more than I do. And apparently there's not really a collection of stories about that. But one of the books that, and I can't remember the title right now, but Cunqueiro wrote a book that deals with stories and tales related to the sea.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out
so
now.
So it's possible
that
you may see some... mermaids or sirenas, no,
well,
of some kind.
Well, like in Celtic lore, there's selkies. So, yeah. Okay, cool.
That would be something that he really would be
interested in,
and I think you would probably find a conversation with him fairly interesting since you are so much into folk traditions and folk literature. You're listening to a new episode of
Tracing Text
with
Sylvia
and Anton, and we're happy to be here for the eighth time. This is our eighth episode, and we're talking about the work of Galician/Spanish author Álvaro Cunqueiro, who was born in 1911 and passed away in 1981.
Hey, and to get back on track, let's continue on with, you know, you were talking about Merlin and y Familia, or Merlin and Company, and all the tales that he incorporated. So
yes, and Merlin and Company, as you said before, is a good translation because the book doesn't really talk about the family of Merlin.
Right.
But it talks about the people that kind of gravitated toward Merlin in his old age, in this case. So you're not really going to find King Arthur necessarily in this book. But what you will find will be stories that are based on oral traditions and oral tales that Cunqueiro was really interested in. This is really a time in the career of Álvaro Cunqueiro, the 1950s. When he really takes advantage of his belief in the Celtic past of the Galician people, an idea that is itself a myth, really. Mm-hmm. When we try to trace our race, so to speak, or our genetically back to, you know, times long past that were supposedly heroic and, you know, pre-Roman, pre-Greek, you know, this is always problematic because you can actually smell the fiction there most of the time. So sometimes it's done with a political intention, sometimes maybe with an economic intention, but in this case, you know, throughout the first several decades of his life, Cunqueiro really believed this, and that's why he was interested in the neo-trovadorismo, you know, the old medieval songs and, and poems from the troubadours, and that's why he was interested in these folk tales. Now, I have a couple of quotations here from Álvaro Cunqueiro himself, because he gave lots of interviews throughout his life. As I said, some of them are available on YouTube, you know, both interviews for television and also for different newspapers and publications. He basically was, his life was basically all about literature. That's all he did. And that's what he liked doing the most. But once he was asked about the inspiration for Merlin e Familia, for Merlin and Company, and this is what he responded. He said, "I think that a great part of it comes from my childhood and my roots, from the things I heard as a child, from my country." When he says from my country,
right,
of course,
means Galicia.
He means Galicia, the northwestern region in Spain, to the north of Portugal. From my surrounding area, he says, from my distorting memory, and memory is important in, in his fiction, and particularly in Merlin and Company. From my liking of wonders and miracles, that's the reconstructive side of it. From my love of the things that don't belong to reality, but to dreams. So here we are already treading into the realm of magic and dreams and things that are not rational, which he was really interested in, but he treated them in a very rational way when all was said and done. So there must also be some influence, I suppose, from certain things I read in my childhood and my youth, and from the folk poetry I heard as a child from the people from my region, meaning Galicia again. So he is very clear about where he drew a lot of the inspiration from for this book, for, from his first novel, which was quite successful at the time, I must add.
Right.
Even though now it may not be as well known, and it may be, I wouldn't say forgotten, but you know, it's not the most popular or best known novel of the Spanish 20th century by any means. Now, this interview comes from a book of interviews with Álvaro Cunqueiro that was published in 1994, and that was edited by, actually, a friend of my dad's, Ramón Nicolás, who does a lot of research into Galician literature and of different kinds. And I really recommend it. It's actually written in Galician, but a lot of the interviews are transcribed in Spanish, simply because they were they come from publications that were originally written in Spanish, newspapers, and journals, magazines, stuff like that. So it's clear when he's writing this book that he is really buying into these myths, into this mythical idea of Galician as a Celtic people, which is something that still
I mean,
survives these days.
Right.
I think, for example, the soccer team in Vigo is called Celta de Vigo.
Right.
Celta de Vigo. So that already or still points towards this mythical, probably non-existent, at least not in full, mythic Celtic past.
Right.
So it was. He was really buying into this at this time in his career in the 1950s, and he actually wrote some really good novels based on these ideas.
Right, but what happens then? Does he become disenchanted with this notion that there is this strong Celtic past, or?
Well, not necessarily. I just
it's
think
not
that he you know, his readings into the history of literature and the history of mythology and that sort of thing, history in general too, must have deepened. You know, in the 60s and 70s, and he, not necessarily that he totally changed his view, but his view did evolve. It did change somewhat. So later in his life, and I'm talking now about the 70s, maybe 15, 20 years later, he began to abandon this belief in the Celtic past of Galicia, and he began to diminish its importance in some of the interviews that he that he gave at the time. So this is where my next quote comes from, also from the same book of interviews with Álvaro Cunqueiro. And he said, about two decades later, there is nothing left here, meaning in Galicia, of the mythology of other Celtic regions. Now, when he says nothing, he's probably exaggerating.
Right. He went from one extreme
to the next.
Yes, now, because we know there are some Celtic mounds, like the dolmens in the Galicia area.
Yeah, they have there are certain remnants of old villages that the Celts seem to have. Celts of, you know, not clear where they were coming from or anything, but the remnants are still there. That is for sure. So this idea of there's nothing left here of the mythology of other Celtic regions, this is very human, really, if you think about it. You know, people move from one opposite, from one end of the spectrum to the opposite end of the spectrum, or sometimes very easily.
Right.
It's a little bit exaggerated when he says this. And then he says, the number of Celts that once lived in Galicia was negligible. I think Celticism, el celtismo, is more a literary phenomenon than anything else. And Galicians liked to belong to that wandering and mysterious race. So this idea that the identity of the group is based on a certain like.
Right. They just simply...
I like the Celts. I want to be a Celt. You know, whether I am or not doesn't matter.
But that's what they kind of idealized to a certain extent. Like, as their myth that provides, like, an origin myth, basically.
Yeah, that's right. So in many ways, wouldn't you say that in the 15 to 20 years in between one quotation and the other, wouldn't you say that he's taken a much more rational approach?
He has. Right? What I find interesting, like, not to digress too much, but I see that there are certain, like, parallels in his life where he goes from, he wasn't as extreme in his politics, but he does go from right to left. He does, like, when he has this, like, belief in the Celtic past, it's almost like a supernatural or religious belief that then he stops believing and he takes a very rational approach. So it's interesting. There are these parallels of going from, you know, one side of the spectrum to the other. So, you know, maybe you could talk a little bit about that too.
Well, you know, the interesting thing about Cunqueiro is that, you know, he had some very progressive sides to some of what he did and some of what he thought. There were also some conservative sides to it, which is, I think, absolutely normal.
Right.
You know, nobody's totally
one thing
liberal
or the other. Yes.
Or, you know, totally conservative. But in his case, a lot of his beliefs were shaped by this nationalist feeling about the value of Galician culture and the value of the Galician language and how he was one of the writers carrying the torch of Galician literature. He was very conscious about that, and it was something that was very important for him. And I think that really helped shape a lot of his literary creation, as well, of course, as the myths that he was so interested in, and that really shaped a whole lot of his works throughout the decades. That's something, you know, this magical realism, this mythical view, this mythical stance, is something that does not quite disappear from his works, you know, neither the novels nor the short stories.
Okay, like the framework of that of his work,
yes,
it still has those mythical elements.
Yeah, in fact, you know, in my upper division literature classes, when I teach survey of Spanish literature. You know, I like to include a couple of texts by Álvaro Cunqueiro because he's just so different and he's just so funny. And what he writes is really valuable, I think. It's very imaginative. It's very witty. And for example, you know, one of the texts that I use is called El Paraguas Jacinto. And it's the story about a man, Jacinto, who was eaten by an umbrella. and all of a sudden, the umbrella can talk.
Uh-huh.
And it can stick its tongue, I would say is, no, in this his, in this case it would be its, right?
It's
stick its tongue out. And so, you know, this is seen in the work as something absolutely normal.
Right.
Somebody finds this umbrella and shows it to Jacinto's wife. And as soon as the umbrella sticks its tongue out, the wife says, "Oh, yes, that's my husband." And actually sleeps with the umbrella. Yes. So for her and for the characters this is just a normal thing.
So it's almost like he transfigures or changes into shapeshifts to some degree into an umbrella, even though he's like consumed by the umbrella, becomes the umbrella then.
Yes, and it's just not seen as something strange, just like in some of Kafka's work.
Right.
The fact that somebody turns into a bug
is
not seen as something strange, right?
No.
This is where this idea of magical realism comes from. And that's what he does. This is why Álvaro Cunqueiro's literature is sophisticated or reconstructive literature, because what it's doing is it's taking all of these, you know, magical, supernatural elements, hard to explain, and just showing them, bringing them to the present, bringing them to the modern world.
As though they're facts.
As they were something normal.
Yeah.
You know, like if I'm drinking this bottle of water, you know, and all of a sudden, you know, I can fly. And that would be a normal thing.
Yeah.
You know? Of course, it's not going to happen. But, but within the fictional world.
Within his fictional world, it does.
It does. And it's absolutely normal, right? You're listening to a new episode of
Tracing Text
with
Sylvia
and Anton, live from deep in the heart of the state of Tennessee. You like that part.
I do, I do, because I, you know, it reminds me.
Reminds you of deep in the heart of Texas?
Yes, and I know
which
that's
is
why
where you're from.
I know, and that's why it makes me laugh every time.
We're talking today about Álvaro Cunqueiro, and we're having a great time, just like I do every time I read something by or about Álvaro Cunqueiro. And we're just about getting ready to wind down here and finish our episode of Tracing Texts. And really, I encourage everyone out there to look this book up, Merlin and Company, Merlin y Familia, or in Galician, Merlin e Familia. And really, you know, give it a chance and read it, because it really is not just fun, which it is, but it really makes you think about things in a different way, from a different perspective, because that's what Cunqueiro always does in his prose, in his novels or stories, or also in his really interesting newspaper articles.
Yes. So hopefully our listeners out there will take this recommendation and learn a little bit more about Cunqueiro.
Yes, and really to end the episode, I would like to point out or to underscore the fact that the important thing about Merlin and Company is not really whether there was a Celtic past in Galicia or not, but the literary use of that tradition that Cunqueiro makes in works such as, you know, Merlin and Company or Las Crónicas del Sochantre. That's basically what he's saying in that quote. He's saying it's more a literary phenomenon than anything else. And I agree. It is important. If we're using that tradition, whether
it's real or not, it's become real in a sense, because that is the current reality.
It has become material, yes.
Right. By going back into the literature or the traditions.
Absolutely. And fiction and magic and storytelling were of paramount importance to Álvaro Cunqueiro at a time, the dictatorship of Francisco Franco, when most novels written in Spain concentrated on social or political issues in sort of a roundabout way to avoid
censorship. And some of them are during that period are quite dry, I think. So I have to read Kincaid.
I tend to agree.
because they have that political or social, and you know they're being censored, so...
Yeah, and sometimes there's ominous feel to them, right?
Yes, they feel very heavy during this period.
That's true, and that kind of contrasts a little bit with some of what Kincaid was doing. I mean, it definitely contrasts with what Kincaid was doing and also with what the boom writers start doing in the mid to late 1960s. Kincaid was really following a totally different pathway, and he was creating works of what I call and what some critics have called sophisticated or reconstructive literature that I think should be acknowledged as the forebears of magical realism. When you think about magical realism, you can't just think about, you know, the Latin American writers of the boom or Borges or even Kafka, right? Mm-hmm. Or some other writers of the period, but you have to think that there was somebody in the northwest of Spain,
who also was
in the 1950s, who was contributing to this trend and to this technique and to this literary element. And that someone was Álvaro Kincaid. And I think Merlin e Familia, or Merlin and Company, is the perfect example. And that's why I think it's great that the novel has been translated into English, so that, you know, everyone in the English-speaking world can just open that book and read it and... understand what this is about and pretty much widen their understanding of what magical realism is, or what we could call sophisticated reconstructive literature, Sylvia.
Excellent. I think it's been fascinating discussion. I really enjoyed it.
Well, you know, my father, who, you know, was a high school teacher, he's now retired. And he has also written a sizable amount of children's books and also books of poetry for adults. And he actually got the chance in the 1970s to meet Álvaro Kincaid one afternoon. And he always speaks very fondly of that occasion. I wish I had the chance to meet him as well. He definitely sounds and reads and even on TV looks like a very interesting, fascinating personality. So he is definitely one of my favorite writers in Spain or in any place in the 20th century. And I strongly recommend his work in English or Spanish or Galician or any other language into which his works have been translated, which there are several of. I think some of them have been translated into French, Italian, German. So now, Sylvia, what are you thinking of presenting on the next time
well,
we meet for a recording?
Theme. You know what?
No, wait a second. Is it? It's definitely not deep in the heart of Texas.
Well,
you like Texas, of course.
I do. I love Texas.
But I would have to say that it probably is either feminism or the femme fatale, or a mixture of both.
A mixture of both. But this time, instead of a Mexican writer, I'm actually going to be presenting about a Spanish writer. And actually, she's a Catalan writer. So it's not going to be the northwestern part of Spain, but the northeastern part of Spain.
So we're going to cross the whole country.
Yes.
Right? It doesn't take that long, really.
No, it doesn't. I haven't been to the northwestern
part,
but I should.
Probably takes longer to cross Texas than it does to cross Spain. And so there are also femme fatales in Spain. Now, when I lived there, I didn't see any.
Oh. Well, in my novels, there are.
But in the novels,
well, this
are.
One is going to be more like a novella.
Okay.
It's not, it's more than a short story. It's longer than that, but it's, but it's not a full-length novel, and I'm going to be focusing on Ana María Moix and her work called Las Virtudes Peligrosas.
So the Dangerous Virtues.
Yes.
Oh, that sounds very, you know, femme fatale-like, right?
Yes. So I'll be talking about that, and hopefully you'll join us for our next podcast, number 9. We'll have to celebrate when we have our 10th.
That's true, yeah.
We'll have to go elsewhere so we can have, like, some champagne.
Yeah, sure. Maybe we could record it at a bar. Or
I know, we'll have to do something
but
like
we should
that.
Do the recording before we break out the champagne.
True. Well,
or maybe not. It doesn't matter, but you know, the show might be even better.
It might be an experiment that may lead to a more productive session.
Drink responsibly, though, everyone out there who's listening, okay? Now, the podcast will be available, as usual, on Podomatic.
iTunes, which you can download, and you can subscribe to our podcast. It's also going to be available through YouTube, because you upload it through YouTube as well.
Yeah, it's fairly easy to do, and I think it probably widens the audience of the podcast. So it will be available on Podomatic, iTunes, and YouTube, but also we have ways of getting in touch with Sylvia and myself, Anton. So, what are those?
You can email us at tracingtext, which is tracingtext@gmail.com. We welcome any comments or suggestions. We also welcome any comments or suggestions on iTunes as well, whether they're positive or negative or just constructive criticism. We welcome that as well. It would really help our podcast.
Good. Also, if you want some sophisticated or reconstructive criticism, that would be fine too.
Yes, that would be great. So do get in touch with us and let us know how we're doing.
Okay, well, that's all from us for now. This has been a new episode of Tracing Text with
Sylvia
and Anton, and we come to you live from
the heart of Tennessee.
That's right. Signing off now. Thank you very much. We'll see you next month.
Goodbye.